decision. Everything has causes. And these causes are brought about through the coming together of different conditions. So in that sense, nothing is haphazard, random. And this is in case you're wondering how you got here. And what are the conditions that have brought you here? One thing leading to another, maybe you saw an advertisement on the website, and that website is put together by someone else, a group of people, and they receive the information, technology, learning how to do it, and they put it on the website. But their ability to do that come from maybe learning that technology, learning how to be a webmaster, learning from teachers. Their very existence come from their parents and upbringing process, how they came to Buddhism or Chan, Zen. So because all of these things come together, then that instant of you seeing an advertisement on the website is the ripening of all of these conditions. And the conditions change and our experience also change. So the workings of causes and conditions, and of causes and effects, is the heart of the Buddhist teaching. It's the core principle of the Buddhist teaching, which includes the teaching of Chan, Zen. How many of you are not familiar with Chan, Buddhism? Please raise your hand. Okay. Buddhism is quite unique in that there is no single set of doctrines. There are many different teachings, and many schools evolved from these teachings. And Chan Buddhism is merely one particular school. Right? Some of you may be more familiar with the Japanese pronunciation of Chan, which is Zen. Right? Yes?
Yeah.
Okay. Zen is the pronunciation of the Chinese word Chan, which refers to a movement, a school, tradition within Chinese Buddhism. And it emerged, I would say, self-consciously as a distinct tradition apart from other forms of Buddhism in the 7th century CE, Common Era. And it arose mainly as a reaction against Buddhist scholasticism. Buddhism was transmitted to China through India in the 1st century CE. Some say maybe 1st century BCE, so somewhere between 1st century BCE to CE. And it came with all sorts of missionaries bring different Buddhist texts, which is another unique aspect of Buddhism. It has no one single Bible or scripture. It has thousands. And these missionaries belonging to different traditions of Indian Buddhism brought the text that they favored as superior, most effective. So you can imagine different missionaries come, bring different types of texts to China, engage in translation, and these different teachings, some of them were contradictory to one another as Buddhism has evolved for 500 years in India already. So it's like someone bringing textbook to a place that has no educational system, like one particular type of maybe spiritual educational system. Sometimes they favor elementary school texts. Sometimes they brought college texts. Sometimes they brought PhD texts. Sometimes they brought random, without any coherent system. So the Chinese were quite confused, right? So for the first 1,000 years, texts were being translated into Chinese. Of course, along the way, schools have evolved, emerged as distinct traditions. But for the first, let's say, a good 500 years, first century to the 5th, 6th century, Buddhism was in China was only really beginning to understand what the spiritual tradition is. It's not like modern technology, we have internet, instant, you know. If you go to Google or Yahoo, they can translate the text for you. You know that? You can, if you search some foreign language, you can click translate. Of course, if you hit that, it's kind of just translating words, right? It doesn't really make sense. Buddhism was like that in China. They used their own way to translate Buddhist key terms. And what did they use? Their indigenous knowledge, tradition of Confucianism, which Confucius lived 5th century BCE, around the same time as the Buddha, the historical Buddha, BCE. So it has evolved 500 years, 600, along the way. Also Taoism, what we would term Taoism. But in the beginning of the 1st century, it's basically disparate textual communities that practice different contemplative techniques, kind of macrobiotic, alchemical kind of diet trainings, and also different eremitic traditions. Hermits live in the mountain, practice meditation, contemplation. Not a single tradition we call Taoism. It's just these people that meditated. And, so the terms that these elite people that can read and write in the Confucian tradition, in the classics, and read about kind of meditation manuals, indigenous Chinese meditation manuals, and try to practice them. They were translating Buddhist texts through Taoist terms and Confucian terms. So it's just confusion. Basic teachings of Buddhism, such as the nature of emptiness, the interdependence, they use terms like the Tao, right? The way, they use terms such as yin yang to translate certain Buddhist key ideas, which was completely off. Right? So there's a lot of confusion for the first couple hundred years. Then as more missionaries came to China, more people practiced Buddhism, gained personal understanding of some of these teachings. Then translations became more accurate. And Buddhism entered the next phase of scholasticism, trying to actually understand what these teachings are. Why are there so many different texts? And they say different things. Some of them contradictory to one another. So around the 5th century, the core of this Buddhist scholasticism period, there emerged a particular Chinese Buddhist formulation called Panjiao. In translation, it's called doctrinal classification. Right, for the first few hundred years, they were translating text. Now, at that time, they're able to see a coherence and a system to these variant texts. And they were able to put it into a hierarchy. This is elementary school level teaching. This one is a little bit more profound. And that one is really advanced. So put it into a hierarchy in order to comprehend the whole of Buddhism. So it is against this phase, period of kind of scholasticism, trying to understand Buddhism. Of course, people practiced, but they were more interested in classification, different terms, different ideas, different practices, which one was more profound, which is more less profound, which one should practice first, right, which one should practice subsequently. A lot of intellectualization. Against this background, Chan emerged. Self-consciously as in the 7th century as a distinct tradition that presented itself. This is the fourfold axiom of Chan, of Zen. Practice everywhere in East Asia and also in the West. First one is a tradition outside of doctrine. The first line. Second line, that does not establish itself based on words and language. And of course, along with the concepts and labels and all these categories. Third line, direct pointing at the human mind. Heart. Fourth line, and attain Buddhahood. Can you all remember that? A tradition outside of doctrine that is not established based on words and language, but directly point to the human heart, mind, in order to realize Buddhahood. That is, after all, the aim of a Buddhist practitioner, to become a Buddha. Not to be reborn in a place, a blissful place, the kingdom of heaven, or with Brahman, or God, but to realize full capacity as a human being in wisdom and compassion. To become a Buddha, to be free from the bondage of suffering. So So Buddhism is a, you may say, is a very humanistic, really a method to realize our full potential. And these four lines are attributed to Bodhidharma. The topic of this series of talks. Whether that's true or not, it's questionable. Historians have, through textual criticism, analyzing different versions of texts, and, come to the conclusion, consensus, that probably Bodhidharma did not say this, but says something similar. And as the tradition evolved, Chan practitioners of subsequent generation kind of pieced together these four essential axioms, core principle of his own tradition against other schools. Right? It's kind of defining mark, trademark. Kind of like corporate identity. So, but irrespective of whether this is Bodhidharma actually said it or not, this is what Chan practitioners of the past have deemed important and saw as defining of their tradition, right, which stemmed from this figure in the 5th, 6th century. His name is Bodhidharma. He was merely one among many missionaries, Buddhist monks that came from Central Asia, India, transmit Buddhism elsewhere. Some went to South Asia, some went to China, and so on. And they continued to do this until Buddhism disappeared in the homeland of India. In the 12th century. So Tibetan Buddhism, for example, many of you have heard of Dalai Lama. That's the last phase of transmission. It went to Tibet, Buddhism went to Tibet as late as 7th, 8th centuries. It's quite late, right? Quite late. So the version of Buddhism that they got was the version that was practiced in India at that time. Already evolved since the 5th, 6th century BCE all the way to 7th, 8th century. So it already has evolved quite a bit. So that's the version that they got. The version that Chinese people got was the 1st century CE. Still 500 years from the Buddha's time. And from China went on to Korea and Japan and the rest of East Asia. And China was the powerhouse in pre-modern times, and Korea and Japan were kind of pay tribute to the mainland, right? China borrowed, appropriated Chinese culture, political system, partly language, customs. So China could be said to be the second largest, most influential form of Buddhism. First one transmitted to came out of India even earlier than China, that is, to Sri Lanka, quite early on, in the 2nd to 3rd century BCE, southward, to South Asia, right, and all the different countries there. And so second diaspora transmission to China, and then from China, Korea, Japan. Third one would be Tibet. So as all these different regions practice their form of Buddhism, translating different ideas, foreign concepts, they use their own terms, and they add to it its own kind of flavor. So after the phase of scholasticism, Chan emerged as a distinct tradition reactionary to intellectualization, scholasticism. Hence this axiom of not depending on words and language. But this tradition can only exist on the foundation of doctrine, scholasticism. You see? It's like a pyramid. On the foundation of Buddhism, the basic tenets, and teachings, systems of meditation, and so on, then you have Chan. So without this foundation, Chan cannot establish itself. And that's really similar to the course of a practitioner's life. It doesn't matter what tradition you align yourself with. In order to be free from suffering, the problems of life, you have to understand suffering. You can't ignore it. You have to immerse yourself, understand the nature of suffering, the causes, and try to remove those causes and enhance those parts, strengthen the aspects within you that make you happy. So this is a process of self-growth, spiritual maturation, right? Then you can be completely free from the Buddhist perspective, self-referential, all kinds of self-referential clinging, attachments, and so on. So we must make the self very strong, healthy, solid, in order to realize, as a foundation, in order to realize such lofty Buddhist teachings as no self, emptiness. So, just like a person goes through the phase of kind of unhealthy self or unsure sense of self to a solid self, sense of self, a very grounded, healthy sense of self, to the stage of no self, selflessness, these three stages. Similarly, just like this, we must build a foundation in understanding what the Buddha taught. Get it right first. And then, you know, take from it what's useful and leave behind things that you can't understand, not useful. And slowly, as you use the teachings to, you understand the categories, different concepts, the words and language, right, then you can be free from them. Do you understand this parallel? It's like martial arts. How many of you practice martial arts? Okay. You gotta get the forms down first. Right? Before you, like, you know, like the highest level of martial arts, you know, your enemy and you are one, you know, something like that, or you're just so good you don't even think about it, the moves. Similarly, it's like that. Okay. You perceive no enemy in the midst of battle, combat. If you still think of him, me, this opposition, you're too busy thinking of how to block this person, how to, if you're one with the person completely, then it's like left hand hitting the right hand. You know exactly how to respond. You don't have to think about it. Right? It's not like this, like left hand hold on to the right hand. It's like left hand, hold on to the right hand. It's like play. Or it's like playing tennis. You want to be good at it, you don't start with someone who's like Olympic champion. You'll never be able to hit back. You can't even have your strokes right yet. Right? So you gotta hit the wall first. Hit the wall. Bounce back and forth. Get your strokes down. And then you apply it, your technique, to someone who's actually can actually play. And the better this person is, the better you become. So all of us practicing sitting meditation, facing the wall, which we'll talk about in the text, the Bodhidharma talks about, it's like playing against the wall, tennis. It's just the foundation. And you have to apply the teaching to daily life so that you can be happier, live healthier, free from vexations, troubles, and bring forth your full potential as a human being. And this potential is characterized by, very simply, wisdom and compassion. Truly compassionate and true wisdom. And this wisdom and compassion is not something that's you become very smart. Not necessarily. An illiterate person can become a wise person. It's not through study. So the Buddha taught many different teachings on different occasions in response to different situations and different people. So there's no set teaching. And all of these teachings, sometimes a person is too attached to his own possession. Right? And then the Buddha taught generosity, cherishing others. Right? Because the self-attachment and material attachment ultimately will lead to the person's own suffering. So we teach that. Generosity, selflessness, the giving. If a person is very giving to the extent that doesn't even care about his life or her life, very kind of shaky, unsure sense of self, then the Buddha taught, establish a strong sense of self. Counting the breath, something very concrete, working with the breath. For example, one time the Buddha gave a teaching on contemplating corpse. Right? Several of his disciples were very attached, sexually attached to the opposite sex. Sexually attached, okay. Attached to the opposite sex, right? So the Buddha gave a set of teaching on contemplating corpse. How? These are monks. They live a celibate life. But if all day long they're thinking of women and opposite sex and so on, that's not too conducive to meditative practice, right? So the Buddha said, well, you gotta detach yourself. So what constitute the human beings are all of these parts, earth, water, fire, or heat, and wind, air. In terms of the earth, it comes from 36 different parts, including saliva, feces, bones, sinew, flesh, all of these parts, 37 of them. Water, generating heat. So, it's due to all of these conditions that constitute the physical body, the appearance. So next time you see someone who's very beautiful, beautiful smile, right? A smile from the teeth, you imagine the skeleton. From the teeth, you see up here, the skull, the structural facial structures, the cheekbones, and the eye socket, and then see if you're attached to that person more. So, and then there's a whole system. He laid out a whole system of meditation, right, as an antidote, kind of cure. Imagine a person dead. Right? Not only bones, but dead. Right? Beautiful, fresh. Maybe someone can still be sexually aroused by a freshly deceased person. Right? But imagine the stages of decomposition, bloating up, discoloration. Then little sentient beings will be born inside the body. And they will come out in different pores. Right? And then all this, meditating on different stages. Until one reaches, not just end with pure disgust, but until one should start with oneself first. Right? Until one ends up with pure white bones. The wind have already blown away the excess flesh, sinew, right? All of those things, the pile of bones just already purified through the rain washing away and meditating on the pure whiteness, entering into meditative absorption. We call samadhi. Deep meditation through just whiteness, pure light. So it's different stages. And some of his disciples weren't that good of listeners. So when Buddha went away to a different region, they kept on practicing. And some of them actually committed suicide. These monks, this body is so impure, you know. Disgust arose. Requesting fellow monks to kill each other. You know, I want to really be liberated. So please help me by killing me. Right. Give me a boost. Right. This body is so impure, blah, 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 blah. So the monks were killing each other, pushing off cliffs and, you know, jumping off trees. And one of Buddha's disciples found out, says, Buddha, we're in trouble. That town that we left, I just walked by, and these monks, they have no contact. They misunderstood your teaching, and they're killing themselves. And the Buddha went back, says, "Okay, let me give you a new teaching. Right? Now they're attached to annihilation, not attached to his existence anymore. They're attached to annihilation." The Buddha said, "You guys gotta stop practicing that, and let me give you a new method called Anapanasati." Awareness of breath. It's much safer. That's the origin of this method of meditating on the breath. Right? So everyone become very happy and meditate on the breath. Still enter into deep meditative absorption, extreme focus of mind, right? Which is the foundation to generating wisdom. You have precepts, you have concentration, we have wisdom. These are the threefold studies in Buddhism. All different systems can be subsumed under these three. Right? Precepts is not commandment. It presents itself as a preparation ground to developing concentration. Right? Draw in your senses, your sense attachment to this and that. Reining in. As the interior becomes more heightened, concentration develops, less involved with all the things out there. Right? In our modern time, new cell phone, right? New cars, right? The latest thing, whatever that may be. You know, all of these things, sense objects that we attach to, just draw in by upholding precepts. And monks have hundreds of them. So make sure that the mind is kind of reined in, controlled, which. When the light of the mind is turned inward, awareness naturally develops, which prepares the ground for concentration. Right? And concentration leads to insight. It's like the sunlight. I often give this analogy. The sunlight, when scattered, no power. At most, you get a tan, you know, lying there for 20 hours. Right? But if you use a magnifying glass, you can expedite this process. Not of getting tanned, but of accomplishing many tasks, generating energy. And that's like the purpose of concentration. Focusing the mind, having a method to focus on, instead of the mind being scattered, now reins in, focused on one point. Then that point becomes focused, insight can generate. With that focus and clarity, when you apply that to your homework, your job, or the nature of reality, then you will have wisdom. You will penetrate into how things actually exist, outside from our own preferences, likes, dislikes, judgments, categories, words, language, all the things that we project onto the world and those around us. Those that benefit us, we deem friend. Those who not, we label them enemy. Meanwhile, that's not how things actually exist. Things exist interdependently, right? Apart from our own labeling. Right? Even a mass killer, criminal, has something that's good. The humblest person has something that other people just can't stand. So that means these criteria are our own. We live in a world through our own upbringings, our own baggage, experience, knowledge. We color the world the way we want to. And this is not understanding how things actually are. And wisdom is that penetrative insight into understanding how things actually are. And what this thing is the nature of suffering. Our suffering and how to be free from it. That's the Buddhist task. Right? And that's the aim of all traditions of Buddhism. China, Tibet, Korea, Japan, Vietnam, and everywhere. What is distinct about Chan, however, is that it does away with extraneous teachings, ritual, apparatus, right? Expedient teachings. So one meditate and come to understand directly the nature of the mind and become a Buddha. So there's a direct, so what those, the axiom, we turn into the axiom, is that there's a direct relationship with our minds, our hearts, and full awakening, Buddhahood. You have a question?
What
yes.
Would be an expedient?
I'll get to that.
Okay.
So it is saying that once you realize the nature of the mind, you have that penetrative insight to understand the workings, the nature, the essence of the mind, your heart, you will become a Buddha. So that is the directness. So its method is embodied in the text that we're going to talk about. Tonight being the first night of the series, I'm providing a context to understand, to appreciate this particular set of teachings by Bodhidharma, right, which he considers the marrow of his teachings. Um, the larger context is Buddhism, Scholasticism, and what he deemed most useful, or most direct way. Now in the West, we must have a foundation before we receive this direct teaching. And that's why I went about talking about this context. And to fill in a little more, aside from the expedient teachings of precepts, of developing concentration, and then wisdom, not wisdom straight away. You gotta live an ethical life, a healthy life. You gotta develop concentration, and there are all kinds of methods to rein in the scatteredness of the light of our minds so it can be focused. And then with that focus, clarity, you'll be able to penetrate into the nature of this mind. So that would be the most direct way. And this process is also gradual, it seems. You gotta face the self. You gotta strengthen the self, be healthy, have a grounded sense of who you are, what you can do, what you can't do. Mature the self, and then realize no self. No self is the heart of the Buddhist teaching. But itself is also just the teaching. You see? The teaching of no self was taught because people hold on to their sense of self. And with people that have no sense of self, unsure, then the Buddha taught self first. You gotta develop a self. Ethical, moral sense of self. It's benefit yourself and others, those around you. On that foundation, you realize no self. See. No self very quickly. Being the core, one of the core teachings that free us from attachments and suffering. Simply means interdependence. That all things have no permanent, separate, independent sense of self. The self does not mean personality. You have personality. After enlightenment, you have personality. Right? It's not that you don't know your name, you don't recognize anyone, right? Your mind is blank. Right? It's not that. It's this fundamental way that we are wired to assume there's some permanency, separateness, independence, autonomy within you and within all things. That assumption, Buddhism says, is wrong. What you consider as separate, independent, permanent, solid, it's actually the coming together of everything else. So book comes from non-book. Bell comes from non-bell. Guagu comes from non-guagu. Book comes from paper. Paper comes from trees. Tree comes from rain. Rain, water, ground, the clouds, the factory, the ink, the publisher. Everything just comes from everything else. Everything is interrelated. Everything to infinite expanse. The bell comes from bronze. I think it's bronze. Casting, right? Coloration. The machine that made this. The person who invented it. So everything comes from everything else. But when we assume that things are permanent, not changing, separate, independent, not interdependent, but independent, then we get in trouble. That's where our suffering comes from. like my opinion is different from yours. In that assumption, there's a me, mine, as if your opinion doesn't change, it's just your opinion. But your opinion constantly change. After the meeting, it changed. When I was younger, I used to listen to a punk rock band called The Clash. Should I stay or should I go? We can't make up our minds, constantly changing. Our opinions, what we assume to be me, mine, actually come from everyone else. So it's this assumption that causes us problem when we make decisions in our life based on judgments. Because when you have your opinion, then other people have theirs. Then conflict, opposition. Each one thinks their position is the best. So failing to see the interdependence, other perspectives on things. Right. A kind of intrinsic openness to experiences and opinions and values. What's valuable in one culture is deemed not valuable, harmful in another. What's a custom of one place is totally wrong in another. So it's flexibility, intrinsic kind of fluid openness to things, interconnectedness of things. That is emptiness. That's no self. So when a person realizes this, not conceptually based on words and language, but experientially, for the first time, that person is not filtering the world through his own judgments, categories, and labels. That's what frees a person from bondage to full awakening, Buddhahood. You see, that's how suffering is released. It's a long context too. But nonetheless, I feel it's necessary, right, to provide before we go into the text. Yes.
Do you understand why all this type of thought went eastward but not westward? Because everything you're saying is the antithesis of Western thought. About the judgments and the opinions.
You mean historically went eastward? I think just through historical accidents. It did go west to Rome. To if you go to a Buddhist museum or a large museum, you will see Buddhist statues that have features of Western face, right? Mustache, all the different saints. Why? Because it went to as far as Pakistan, kind of northwest to further, right? So it did, but causes and conditions has prevented it from taking root, right? Largely because it had to contest with indigenous religious traditions, right? Just as sophisticated, powerful, right? Christianity, Judaism, right? Whereas when it went to Tibet, for example, 7th, 8th century, there were not even language systems, so it absorbed Buddhism wholesale, completely, including the language, right? When it went to China in the 1st century, it had a contest with centuries-old Confucian tradition, Taoism too, so it has to wrestle. Changed. Some things were taken, some things were modified. But the East Asians really gravitated to this teaching. Why? The easy answer is causes and conditions. Right? The hard answer would have to be scholars to study. Why? Yes?
When you're talking about the mind, you keep saying the heart.
Mind.
Yes. Just say what you mean by that.
Okay. Speaking in English is much harder. Why? Because there are two words for the same thing. In Chinese, it's just xin, X-I-N, or H-S-I-N, which means kind of a combination between heart, mind, also the corporeal, physical, organ, heart. All of this is embedded in this one single character. But because of our, you know, maybe 20th century, 21st century, modern emphasis on the split between body and mind, heart, brain, and mind, and then I use it just to cover my basis. So heart, mind, so heart slash mind. But what I mean is the workings of your whole being, right? Including the brain, how we are wired to think. So, Bodhidharma was unique. Now, a little bit about Bodhidharma. He was unique in that the legend has it that he brought only one text to China, which is quite rare. Missionaries, they usually bring a lot of text to translate. And he didn't engage in translation projects. He was itinerant. Scholars and historians contend that he lived probably in the 5th century or possibly 6th century. And he came to China. He was a Central Asian monk. Came to China, let's go by one tradition, 6th century. And instead of engaging in scholarly activities, by the 5th, 6th century, large monasteries, imperially sponsored, were already established. Many, tens and thousands of monks already practiced, or practicing, or were practicing Buddhism at that time. So he came, and he was summoned by the Emperor Liang. A very interesting dialogue supposedly happened. The emperor was a great sponsor of, great patron of Buddhism, building monasteries, sponsoring translation projects. So Bodhidharma came to the court. It's like here, this great Central Asian monk. Before his arrival, news has already gotten to China that he will come. So people were expecting him. And being a great monk, master, in the context of building Buddhism, starting monasteries, translation projects, which the emperors were doing, sponsoring, he says, Bodhidharma, I've been doing so much work to strengthen, to establish Buddhism in our land, sponsoring monasteries, translations, and so on. How much merit do I have? The Bodhidharma replied, none whatsoever. You don't answer like that to the emperor. You get your head chopped off. The emperor's already a little bit pissed. He says, none whatsoever. Is it all a waste? Buddhism at that time, as it was understood, was not only a religion, a system of belief, but it was really a more efficacious, more effective way to live the good life. Kind of like America now. It's very popular. Everyone's practicing Buddhism, from Tina Turner all the way to Richard Gere. Right? Gravitating to Buddhism, it's a great kind of self-help, developing spirituality, and so on. So, in the context of China at that time, it was perceived. There were translation projects, but for the general people, including the emperor, it was merit, accruing merit for future lives, or to live a happier life. Spiritual, religious merit. So Bodhidharma says, none whatsoever. And the emperor says, proceeded, he said. He's thinking. I'm going to dramatize this a little bit. So he's thinking, you yourself is a Buddhist monk who teaches karma, future birth, do good deeds, you reap good results. In other words, merit. You yourself are wearing Buddhist robe and you say no, you don't even know your own doctrine? Out of this context, he says, who the hell is standing before me? Of course, I'm traumatizing a little bit. There's no who the hell, that kind of expression back then. But basically he's saying, who is it that stands before me? Right. And Bodhidharma says, don't know. To know suggests me who know, and that which is known. There's a label, there's concept, there's self, there's other, there's all sorts of things. It says, don't know. Now the emperor is just, before he was pissed, now he's just confused. This is a great monk. We've been receiving news that you're coming and you don't even, you don't know your own doctrine. You don't even know who you are. Right? But Bodhidharma is testing the understanding of the emperor. Unfortunately, he failed the test. He's revealing the highest truth of selflessness, of not grasping after expedient teachings such as accruing merit, doing good deeds, benefiting other people, to accrue good karma, and have a good stock of karma, and then I can be reborn in a better place and so on. He says, not a single merit. To have merit assumes someone who's performing merit, other people who receive the benefit, sentient beings, and also the actual act. Self, others, beings, living beings, and the act itself, which Buddhism calls the four emptinesses. He's still within the boundary of doctrine. He's just kind of testing. He's not kind of crazy. He's actually speaking in perfect alignment with Buddhist truth. But the emperor didn't get it. Who is it that stands before me? Me and you, opposition. Self, others, opposition. The Bodhidharma says, don't know. He didn't even say, I don't know. He just says, don't know. And then the emperor says, since you don't know, please leave. He's already excusing him very kindly. Because ordinarily, if someone replied this to the emperor, your head is gone. You don't say something like this to the emperor. Right? Of course, if we say something to superior now, living in a democratic country, say, Obama is going to say, well, shake hands, it's okay. But back then, not so democratic, okay? It's pretty intense. He's already giving him a break by sending him off. He said, okay, you can leave now. And then the emperor consulted his advisors. His advisors said, oh my goodness, he was revealing to you the ultimate truth. And then the emperor says, well, send him back. Bring him back to court. I want to build him a monastery. So he can live there. in my domain and teach me and everyone else in the court. And then his advisors, it's already too late. Nothing will bring him back. And Bodhidharma went to different places. And what he witnessed, what he saw was people practicing religious merit, translations, doctrine, intellectuals, debates about what is right, what is wrong, right, wrong, good, evil, all these constructs through which people graft onto the world. Not the ultimate truth. Therefore, Bodhidharma found a cave behind a mountain, and legend has it that he sat in there for 9 years to wait for the person who's ripe for his teachings. He had only 4 students in China, but from these 4, we have a whole tradition that developed. So it's not quantity, it's quality. Right? At the end of his life, he asked his students to reveal their understanding. One student stated his understanding. He says, "You have my skin." Superficial. And a nun, the other nun, student, revealed her understanding. He says, "You have my flesh." A little bit better. Third one. He says, "You have my bone." That's pretty good. The fourth one, when he asked, "What is the meaning of the Buddha Dharma, the Buddha's teaching, all these things, sutras, scriptures, what is the meaning of them?" And Huike, remain silent. And at that moment, Bodhidharma says, "You have my marrow. Essence." And then he transmitted his robe, Bodhidharma's own robe, and begging bowl, monk's begging bowl, to Huike. From Huike stemmed the whole Chan tradition. He was considered, in the Chan tradition, the second patriarch, lineage master. First one is Bodhidharma. A teaching outside of doctrine, free from words and language, mental constructs, whether this construct is good or bad, it's still a construct. Something that directly reveals the teaching, the heart, mind, cannot be fathomed through words and language. Realize Buddhahood. So that's the context. Now there's another interesting story with the second patriarch, Huike. When he first sought out Bodhidharma for teachings, he lay outside the cave for days in the snow on his knees. Bodhidharma still sat in the cave without receiving him, until took a knife to show his resolve. He said, "I would do anything to receive teachings from you." And Bodhidharma says, "I have nothing to teach you. What is it that you seek?" "Seek." Our mind is always seeking true teachings, better teachers, right? Or this and that. Before, people are interested in, you know, like spiritual, or like materialism. New cell phones, new clothes, new cars, this and that, the latest trend. After a person started practicing some kind of spiritual tradition, they substituted with you know, doctrine and words and stages of practice and, you know, how many prostrations did you do, how many beads are, my Buddhist mala beads are from India, you know, really good, you know, or my meditation clothes and my cushions made out of kapok fabric, 100% cotton, the best material there is, kind of spiritual materialism, substitution, right? So Bodhidharma tested him. What is it that you seek? I seek the Dharma from you. Dharma? I have nothing to teach you. I have nothing to say. He says, surely you have something. My mind is not at ease. Huike used to be a general. He killed people for a living before he became a monk. So from guilt of killing, he just left his post and became a monk. And all his life he's trying to overcome this. His mind, not ease. No matter how many sutras he recited, how many things he practiced, nothing helped him. This ease, this weight on his mind. He says, my mind is not at peace. He says, nothing to show you. He took his knife. Back then, monks carried knives. Especially those who sojourn into mountains, they carry a staff. Some carry a knife to ward off animals and also to make food and so on. A knife is one of the 18 things that monks are supposed to carry if you receive the precepts. You don't use a knife to kill people, of course. He used a knife and chopped off his arm. Took the arm in front of Bodhidharma and says, this is my resolve. Willing to sacrifice his life, Bodhidharma says, okay, I'll teach you. He says, why are you not at peace? He says, I've searched all my life as a monk practicing. Nothing works. Bodhidharma says, bring me your mind and I'll pacify it. And Huike says, my mind, where is my mind? What is it that's not at ease? He says, I can't find my mind. Oh, okay, I pacified it already then. Upon hearing that, he became completely enlightened. We hold on to something. Me, I'm not at ease. I need to find something to cure myself. I need to have a method. I need to have some ultimate truth. After all, you're from India. You must know, this is the homeland of Buddhism. You must know the ultimate truth. You must have something precious to give me. Bodhidharma didn't give him a single thing. The mind not at peace? Give me the mind. So you can't find mind. No mind? Huh. We're at peace. Upon hearing that, now, he was ripe, Huike, to receive that teaching. He has gone through practice, gone through putting the leg like a pretzel, like what we're doing, right? Gone through the rigor and studied. Before then, study the concepts. I'm sure he has encountered the teaching of no self, emptiness, interconnectedness, karma, all that. He knows that. But now he's a teaching made live through his own person. You want no self? Bring me a self and then get rid of it. Your values, your categories, that construct the world that we have. And that world is making us uncomfortable. So, take a knife and slash that away. You understand that intrinsically, I'm free. Just like all of us in meditation, we have all of wandering thoughts until in the period of sitting, I said, relax, be natural, clear, appreciate the breath, all these labels and categories I'm throwing out to you. But you're receiving, it's like, oh yeah, relax. Natural, appreciate. Every breath is a new beginning. that helps. Right? That's expedient teachings. And then maybe during the retreat, I'm going to do a little advertisement this coming Saturday, if you're interested in chan practice, get a real taste of it, and you sign up for the retreat if you have not. Maybe in the retreat, in the midst of all your wandering thoughts, and I say to you, who's having wandering thoughts? Your thoughts, let your thoughts liberate themselves. Actually, thoughts do liberate themselves. Wandering thoughts go. Wandering thoughts go. You don't have to do anything about it. They'll free themselves in their own accord. And so instead of using one method to get rid of this other thought, right, negative thought, we use good thought to get rid of negative thought. And then we're stuck with good thought. And then we're going to do something about good thought. Because this good thought and that good thought have conflict. Which thought is good? Right? And then we need a third thought. It's going to, oh, that's the expedient teaching. You know, let me give you a college level textbook teaching. And then you use that to get rid of that. And then I just slash away all those thoughts. Your thoughts liberate themselves. Moment to moment to moment to moment. Instantly. So when you sit, you're completely free. So my advice to you tonight, be free. When you find yourself in the midst of anxiety, dis-ease, bring me anxiety. And I don't want, you want anxiety? Here's my phone bill, my electricity bill, my schoolwork. I don't mean that. You have to do that by yourself. Right? My work, I don't need that. But something in your mind that you're holding to be trouble. Angst. Bring me that. A great practitioner once said, a problem, if you can solve it, it's not a problem anymore. Right? If you can solve it, it's not a problem. If you can't solve it, it's still not a problem. Because you can't solve it, it's not, no longer your problem. Right? So be free. It's like Matrix. All of us are plugged in. Like the movie, all of us are plugged into this constructed world, the collective world. What is good in this society? What is bad? And we all have a built consensus. What should be? What should not be? This is just—it's just consensus, just assumption. Based on good judgments, collectively. But sometimes this good judgment come in contact with some other judgment, then you have conflict. Why? Because they're constructed. They're labels, they're words. Right? So then comes Morpheus. Right? It's going to save you, it's gonna unplug you. And you, once you unplug, you're like Neo. You're like saying, bullets? In the constructed world, yeah, there's gravity. You know, bullets come. I have to duck. And Morpheus says, you don't have to duck. Just the bullets just fall down, whatever. You can just fly through the air, whatever. You're completely free. And Neo was still in his fantasy. I can only do that when I'm plugged into Matrix. And then in episode 3, I think, he was unplugged and he was able to actually function outside the Matrix. Stop the Sentinels. I don't know if you remember this, but anyway, outside the Matrix, he's able to. So he's like, he's completely free. So, my advice to you, be free. Not do whatever I want free. Not that kind of free. The freedom that comes from recognizing how things actually exist, how opinions are actually formed, how your troubles come to be. If you examine suffering, you'll discover that suffering boils down to or vexations, anxiety, whatever you want to replace, substitute. Suffering basically boils down to, I want this moment to be other than what it is. Why? Because I already have a model of what I want to be. I don't want this, and I want that. Constructs. These are constructs. You can continue your life substituting this with that. But the most efficient, direct pointing way, the Chan way, is to realize the constructiveness of everything. And to stop substituting and begin to recognize. In this sense, the Buddhist path, Chan path, can be divided into two ways. The path of purification, which means substitution. You gotta, you know, something is impure, you gotta make it pure. You gotta polish it, you know, make it better. And the path of recognition. Chan belongs to the path of recognition. Recognition is purification. This is the Chan way. Do you understand? Right, so instead of wandering thoughts come, something concrete, or vexations arise. Instead of substituting, think of something positive. Think of a flower, or you know, more perspective, try to be understanding. I'm not saying those are bad. They're very good things to do. It's just to recognize that all things are interconnected, intrinsically related, open, connected, empty. Empty of independent, separate, permanent existence. They're all continual flow of openness, connectedness. What the world deems as bad people exists because of good people. The rich exists because of poor. Poor exists because of rich. Good things come to life, causes and conditions fade away, they also disappear. Causes and conditions come about, they reappear. Connectedness. So that is what Bodhidharma deemed as the principle. He teaches in this text, he called two entries and the four practices. Entry through direct realization, through principle, essence, and entry through practice. And practice is divided into four hierarchical levels, each one harder than the former. Right? So the first one is the easiest to practice, and then a little bit harder, and then a little bit harder, and then a little bit harder. So if you can enter the gate of realization, of awakening, just upon hearing this, you get it, first conceptually. Right? Or maybe some of you are enlightened, like, free. Then you have entered through the principle. If you haven't, or you just have an intellectual understanding, and you want more of it, then come back March 1st. The second of the series of talk on Heart Sutra. In the meantime, we practice playing tennis against the wall, the foundation. Right? Meditate, concentrate, live a healthy life, happier life, benefiting yourself and others. Start with the foundation. And next time, you can feel free to take it home. You can study it. Try to see if you understand it. Or you can leave it here. If you choose to leave it here, please pass it forward. We'll end tonight. Thank you.
They can't, they're welcome to just take the food.